All right, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Like I said, coming up 8 o'clock, Adam Hogue and the final Monday evening quarterback of our Chicago Bears season. Find out what went wrong with this year's team and what we can expect from the offseason. Tom Brady. Tom Brady. You want Tom Brady to come to Chicago, John Schmidt?
I'd love to have Tom Brady here.
It's a no-brainer, right? John Schmidt is here. It is that time of the month where we talk about hidden Chicago landmarks. John's been joining us on and off for the last couple months here on the program, a former high school teacher who has written the book Hidden Chicago Landmarks, which we've been talking about. And tonight we're going to talk about a couple of lesser-known fugitive stories. We'll get to it. John, good to see you.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Happy
Justin.
New Year.
And Happy New Year to you,
so
too.
So I realize you were a teacher, and you fell into the issue of, we were just talking about the idea that you have to live the residency requirements. Was that an issue for you, being a teacher in Chicago?
Well, when I first started working for the Chicago Board of Education, it was late 70s, and they did not have a residency requirement. By that time, I was living in the suburbs. When they put it in, sometime in the 80s, they grandfathered us in.
Okay.
So I did not have to move
What was the in. Reason they were telling teachers you got to live in Chicago?
I think it was the idea was when they keep the tax base up. Unlike with the police and the firemen, they said, well, they should be close to where the action would be for their jobs.
I get that, I guess.
But I guess they just wanted us to be part of the community. But Okay.
Well, there you go. We got some more insight from an actual teacher. All right, so we've been talking about all sorts of stories from hidden Chicago landmarks on the program, but let's talk about the lesser-known stories of these fugitives, because everyone's going to know Chicago's fugitive stories, Dillinger and others. But
Oh, yeah, Dillinger. Now, Dillinger is such a big guy. He was America's bank robber, you know, during the 1930s, and when they feds got him outside of the Biograph Theater. That's become a big landmark. All these gangster tourists go to the Biograph Theater over on Lincoln Avenue. But there is a lesser-known landmark a few miles away, and that's a monument to the biggest manhunt since Dillinger. And this is in on Potomac Avenue.
In Wicker Park,
In Wicker Park. Yeah. Nice neighborhood today. And this is where in 1955... the cops caught Richard Carpenter. Now, who is Richard Carpenter?
Who's Richard Carpenter? he doesn't get the big name Johnny Depp movies, Richard Carpenter.
No. He was a low-level punk, a low-level 1929. He's born in Chicago. He grew up. He was always getting in trouble with the law. He was kicked out of the army. He spent prison time for accidentally shooting his mother. And in 1955, he had escaped from jail, and he was already a suspect on a series of these about 100 small-time robberies on the north and west side, and they weren't anything big and flashy like Dillinger. It was like grocery stores and bars and maybe isolated pedestrians or something of this sort. But as I said, a lot of these small-time robberies he was supporting himself with. Well, one day in August, August 16th, detective was on the subway, what's the current red line down around Roosevelt Road, and he noticed a guy on the subway, and he said, it looks like Carpenter, and sure enough, it was Carpenter, and the detective put him under arrest, and he was going to bring him up to the police headquarters, which was at 11th and State then.
Right.
Well, they get to the subway station, and they're going up the stairs, and the cop starts fumbling around, getting the wanted poster, whatever paperwork he has, and Carpenter pulls out a gun. He shoots the cop dead right there.
Wow. And then, right at the subway station.
Right at the subway station, runs up the steps, cars going by on State Street, stops the car at gunpoint, he takes off. So Carpenter gets away. Now, the police, of course, one of their own has been killed, so they start a big manhunt for Carpenter. They start going over all his known haunts. My uncle Robert was a policeman then, too, and he talked about this later, about they canceled a lot of the time off, and some of the cops even came in on their own time because they wanted to nail this guy, but they couldn't find him. So a couple of days go by.
And this isn't like it is today where you could quickly get out on mass transit. I mean, they know he's pretty much in Chicago just because there's not a lot of places he can
go. Yeah. And a couple days later, another policeman's going to a movie on the Biltmore Theater, which is on Division Street. And he's with his wife, and he's walking out, and he sees this one guy sleeping near the back. He thinks, gee, that looks like Carpenter. So the cop sends his wife into the lobby, and he goes back, and he shakes this guy, and sure enough, it's Carpenter. So he wakes up Carpenter, and he puts them under arrest, and they start walking out of the theater, and suddenly Carpenter pulls out a gun.
Oh, my gosh.
From somewhere, and he shoots this cop. Doesn't kill him, though, but he shoots this cop, knocks him out, and Carpenter takes off through the back emergency exit, and he gets away.
And it's funny because they talk about the Biograph Theater with Dillinger and the whole idea of the shootout in theater, and this is the same concept of him hanging out in theaters. I mean, what is with these guys wanting to hang out in theaters?
Well, you could sleep all day there. You know, they have movies all day, and you could hide out, and you could be anonymous over there. Well, Carpenter got hit in the leg by this, and he got away, and people are still looking for him, okay? And this is the early days of television. This is 1955, remember? And wall-to-wall news coverage, practically. You know, they give you bulletins every 15, 20 minutes. No, we still haven't found Carpenter. And I was a kid then, and I remember our parents used him as kind of a boogeyman then. And they'd say, you know, I want to stay out longer. It says, you get inside now or Carpenter's going to get you, you know. So anyway, after he, as I said, he got hit in the leg. And so he limped over from Division Street to Potomac Avenue. And there's, he finds a two flat over on Potomac Avenue. And he starts to break in the second floor. And there's a truck driver living there. And he goes to the back. And he sees this guy over there with a gun. And the guy with a gun says, hey, I'm Carpenter. I just shot another policeman. Now you let me in. You'll be fine. If not, I'm going to plug you right now. So let me in. So let's Carpenter in. And truck driver's there, and he's there with his wife and his two kids, and Carpenter settles down, and he's going to wonder what he's going to do next, and time goes by. And after about 18 hours, Carpenter is holed up, and there he doesn't know what he's doing. He's trying to figure it out. So he starts, you know, getting a little stir-crazy or something. For some reason, he lets the lady take the kids out. Mm. And then after a little later, he lets the truck driver go. Well, the truck driver goes down, and the truck driver notifies the police, and all the police converge on this building on Potomac Avenue. And there's a famous picture they used to have in the press picture they used to have in the Museum of Science and Industry of the siege of Potomac Avenue. They had these lights on the building, and they had like thousands of people. Like the paper said, it was like 2,000 people over there. And they had a helicopter going overhead, and the cops get on the bullhorn and say, Carpenter, come out with your hands up. We're coming in to get you, or whatever they'd say.
Yeah, right.
Well, Carpenter tries to get away again. He tries to, you know, escape through next door apartment. But this time there's more shooting, and this time they got Carpenter. They finally caught him. Well, they're leading him away, and, you know, if Carpenter thought, oh, I'm going to be a bad boy, folk hero like Dillinger, he was wrong, because the people see him, they said, kill him, kill him, kill him.
Oh, he's not a folk hero by any stretch, no.
And 1958, he died in the electric chair.
He did.
But that building is still there in Potomac Avenue. It's still a private residence. Don't bother people there, but drive by it, and there's a picture of it in the book. And
wow, there you go.
Biggest manhunt since Dillinger.
Wow, that's a great story. Hidden Chicago Landmarks is the book. John Schmidt is the author. He's with us once a month here to talk about some of Chicago's hidden history. We'll take a quick break, come back, and talk about a Nazi saboteur and also Red Emma here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Getting some great texts in, John, about the story of Carpenter. 312 says, I lived in Wicker Park at that time. They really did check out all of our houses, yards, garages, etc. I was scared to death, and I walked up to an officer at the end of our block, and I told him, my mother comes home at 1 a.m., will you watch out for her, please? I was a teenager then. We lived on Crystal Street. You get a lot of these stories about people, like you said, you were a kid at the time, 1955. This is history, but it's not ancient history in the sense that a lot of people listening right now remember Carpenter.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. My as I said, my uncle was a cop, and he had pictures of the Carpenter's capture there. He didn't personally capture him, but he was, well, like a lot of cops were now.
I was going to say, it's a well-known story. I mean, obviously, the Museum of Science Industry had the picture up, and people talk about it, but why wasn't that story as big as, say, the Dillinger stories and the more gangster stories of that we knew so well?
Well, Carpenter was a small-time crook. I mean, he never, you know, Dillinger breaking out of jail with what was it, the gun? Shoe polish on the soap or whatever it was, you know. And this guy just was a small time punk. He just happened to be getting away with a lot of stuff. And TV made him actually. He was maybe the first TV crook in Chicago.
Yeah, there you go. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 870 says, being a history nerd, I love when John's on. So that's good.
Thank you.
And people really enjoying this segment that we do each week. So let's keep going here. The Nazi saboteur of Fremont Street.
Right.
This is a great story.
Yeah. You look at this guy's story. He's an immigrant. You know, you tell the story, oh, there's this immigrant. He comes to the United States with his family. He is an ROTC. He becomes a citizen. But then he goes back to his homeland, and he becomes radicalized, and he comes back here, and he becomes a saboteur. Well, you know, this is 1942, mm-hmm. and he's from Germany. His name is Herbie Haupt. And he came to Chicago as a young boy with his parents, became a citizen. He was an ROTC at Lane and a few other places. And what happened was that he went back on, for some reason, he went back to Germany with another guy in 1940, early 1941.
Yeah, that's a strange time to go to Germany.
Yeah, right? Yeah. This is before the United States was in the war,
right.
And they were traveling around. This other guy was like a German citizen, and he gets to Germany, and supposedly what happens is after the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, the United States gets pulled into the war against Germany, and he's in Germany now. So what's he going to do? What's this other guy going to do? Well, the other guy winds up in the German army. Herbie was a little bit different because Herbie spoke perfect English. He knew American customs and so on. And the Germans were launching a plot called Operation Pistorius, and Hitler himself had personally okayed this. Hmm. And the idea was they were going to land these Germans who had lived in America, who could fit in. They were going to land them in America, and they were going to blend in with the population, and they were going to carry out sabotage missions. And so this is what Herbie did. Herbie, one day he shows up at his parents' house on Fremont Street.
Right, and, yeah, Lincoln Park, right.
Yeah, yeah, after, you know, he's
gone. It was 2234 North Fremont. That's what you got here, yeah.
Yeah, don't go around and bother people's house and drive by.
Yeah, that's what your worry is.
But anyway, he shows up at the house. And, you know, he's been gone for like 6 months, a year, whatever it is. You know, where was he? Well, as the saying goes, they didn't ask, he didn't tell.
right.
And so he seemed to have plenty of money, got a job there, and he was bought a new car, and he started dating a neighborhood girl. And then one day, June 27th, 1942, he's driving down, he gets in his car, drives down the street, down Fremont, turns right at Webster and under the L. This other car pulls him over, and it's the FBI.
They were onto him.
And they arrested him. What had happened is that there were these two teams of saboteurs, and one team landed in Long Island, and the other team landed in Florida. Herbie's with the Florida team. Well, the team that landed in Long Island, one of the guys right away gave himself up, and he
told on everybody.
He told on the other guys. Yeah. And so they put Herbie in jail. He's an American citizen, but he's also a spy. And he goes on trial in a, and it's, you got to remember, it's during World War II. He's put on trial in a military court. Mm. President Roosevelt decreed he would be tried in a military court. And they found him guilty. And the case went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court sent out a decision called Ex Parte Quirin. And they said they denied his appeal. He said, well, I'm a U.S. citizen. I should go in U.S. court. No. They denied his appeal. And so Herbie... Roosevelt, the two guys that dropped out of the plot, he gave him mm-hmm. prison sentences, and the two guys that stayed in, including Herbie, were executed.
Wow.
He died in the electric chair.
Did he, during all that stuff going with all the military court, did he deny? Was he trying to be covert?
He said, I was just trying to get back to America. I wasn't any kind of spy, and I figured, well, this would be a good way to get back to America. I didn't want to, but they didn't buy a story. And today, 80 years later, whatever it is, we still don't know how sincere he was.
Really?
You can argue that one both ways.
Yeah, that's a tough one because they didn't really do anything. Like he didn't get to a point yet where there was any sabotage.
No, but you got to remember this was during World War II, and people were they were throwing American citizens of Japanese descent. Remember, they were of Japanese ancestry. Mm-hmm. They were throwing them in concentration camps. So people were being very. Not respectful of civil rights of people.
I know that you are you're diligent when it comes to your homework and you pay attention to this stuff. When you think about this case, is the gut feeling that he was a spy? Was the gut feeling that he kind of got caught up in the rush to judgment because we were at war?
Nah, I think he was a spy, probably. I don't know if I'm a cynic or not, but what was he doing going over to Germany in the first place?
Yeah. It's funny because I had a neighbor when I lived in Lincoln Square in 1996. I had a neighbor who was probably in his 90s who was a soldier in a German army in World War II.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people had that experience where German America or came over and immigrated after the war, and he would tell stories about being an infantry in Germany. I don't think he ever saw any combat or shot at any Americans, but the point being that he was in the German army. So I guess that is a lot of German American. I'm not sure there's a lot of guys around anymore, but
yeah.
We're here. So.
Yeah.
All right. Good story right there about the Nazi saboteur of Fremont Street. And again, Lincoln Park, don't bother the people to live there.
Right.
All right. Let's move on. We got one more story before we wrap here. Let's talk about Red Emma. This is a great story because this is another one that's a little bit, I don't know. Well, let's tell the story. Red Emma.
Red Emma. Yeah. I was writing years ago, I wrote a book, Understand Chicago History. I knew what happened September 11th, 2001, so I decided to look up what happened September 11th, 1901.
Yeah.
And it turned out the most wanted terrorist in America was busted on that day, and that was Red Emma, Emma Goldman. She was accused of being a plot to assassinate the President of the United States.
This was President McKinley?
President McKinley. What had happened is McKinley had gotten shot in Buffalo on September 6th, I think it was. And the guy that shot him was Leon Zolgatz. He was an anarchist. And when they questioned him, he said, well, why did you shoot McKinley? He said, well, I'm an anarchist, and I had heard Emma Goldman speak. And so people thought, oh, Emma Goldman, she already had a reputation for being this the most dangerous woman in America.
This was after the Haymarket riots,
right,
here in Chicago,
that's
which
what
really was the inspiration.
That's what radicalized her, the Haymarket riot, because these guys in the Haymarket riot were unjustly convicted and executed. So she became radicalized, and she was well-known.
So she was going around doing sort of soapbox, speeches.
And right away, the cops busted six of her associates. They couldn't find her, but, you know, where's Red Emma? And then they get news that Emma's on her way to Chicago, and they go down to the train station. They miss her at the train station. Then they get another tip. She's on this place on Sheffield Avenue. And so they go out to the house in Sheffield Avenue.
2126. Don't go there, guys.
This is 1901, remember. And so one of the cops is downstairs. Another one climbs in a window, and they come in, and they see this little lady. She's sitting there, and she's knitting or doing something. She's smiling. Are you? You're Emma Goldman. Oh, no, I'm not Emma Goldman. Well, she was Emma Goldman. She finally admitted it. And they take her down to the police station, and she's very polite, very nice. And she says, oh, yeah, well, McKinley got shot, but that's too bad for him, but he wasn't important. He's just a tool of the monopolist.
Said, yeah.
But no, I didn't have anything to do with it. I didn't met this guy once. I'm innocent, you know. And, well, a few days later, McKinley died. And so Zolgatz, they didn't mess around with Zolgatz. He wound up getting executed very quickly after that. But it turned out that Emma Goldman and her associates, they didn't have anything to do with this plot. And so they let Emma go. And the funny thing is, some years ago, Canadian TV series called The Murder Mysteries, they had something on where Emma Goldman is arrested in the aftermath of McKinley's shooting. But this is a Canadian series. They put it in Toronto. And it's a wonderful series. I love the episode. But if you want to see where this really happened, you got to go down to Sheffield Avenue.
Well, you just talked about the Nazi saboteur. We talked about Carpenter, of course. And it was not, and even the Haymarket riot, the people who were unjustly accused of throwing the bomb.
Oh, yeah.
It was not unheard of in any of these generations to get the chair or to be executed or to wrongly be thrown in jail. So I'm surprised to hear that they found compassion for Emma Goldman. Was it just the idea that they really didn't have anything on her and all they could really prosecute her on was the philosophy?
Yeah, basically it. But a few years later, 1919, the Red Scare, they deported her. And she wound up dying in Canada. But she's buried out in one of the western suburbs. And when she died, they brought her remains back, and she is buried.
Was the cause to deport her at the time? Just because of
just because she was a radical, basically.
It's amazing, you know, to think about that.
1919.
They could do that. Yeah. So Emma Goldman and the story. I mean, obviously Emma Goldman, the name, people know that, especially in the labor movement and the, as you said,
the movie radical, Reds.
Yeah, the movie Reds. But she has this place in Chicago because she's well known, not necessarily for being a Chicagoan or being in Chicago, but because she was caught here and all that, she's here.
Yeah. That's Red Emma's hideout. And the picture I got in the book is of a when she was arrested, the Tribune put an artist, drew her picture, put it right on the front page, September 11th, 1901.
Wow. This is great. You know, it's so, to think about all the stories of, because you could go on and on about the, just straight up the gangster history of this town. I mean, you could go on. I mean, obviously the Carpenter fits a little bit more into that sort of, that feel. But there are so many other stories about run-ins with the law and that have nothing to do with Al Capone or any of that kind of stuff.
Although we got Capone's house in the book.
Yeah. Well, Capone, that's interesting because he's lived a lot of different places. What house do you feature in the book?
Oh, that's the one he lived on Prairie Avenue on the 7100 block. Or what, I can't remember the address offhand, but he had a two-flat over there, and into the book he had it fixed up. We'll talk about it sometime.
Yeah, we'll get in there. John Schmidt is the author of the book Hidden Chicago Landmarks, and it was funny because the last time you were in, we talked about some of the architecture that was used, or at least the schools and stuff from the movie Cooley High. Mm-hmm. And I went and watched Cooley High because we discussed it. It lost to Ferris Bueller, by the way. But it was amazing to look at that time and look at all the architecture of the Near North Side and all the different buildings that are no longer there.
How is the Untouchables doing?
The Untouchables is still in it. It's in the final eight. Yeah.
Because I'm doing a library gig on Wednesday night, and that's one of the things I got. I got a picture from the Untouchables movie because it ties in with what I'm talking about.
It'll be at the Clearing Branch Library. That's 6423 West 63rd Place. Clearing Branch Library. This will be Wednesday night at 6 p.m. going to about 7:30 or so. But you can go see John, who'll be talking about many things. Hidden Chicago Landmarks is the name of the book. John, great to see you, and we'll talk next month.
Okay, thanks, Dustin.
All right, coming up here in the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with Adam Hoag, talk about the Monday evening quarterback, of course, and what the Bears should do coming up here in the offseason. Some interesting developments in the last couple days. Obviously, we saw safety Eddie Jackson get his big contract. He's the highest paid safety in the NFL. We saw today that last night that Kyle Long has decided to end his career. He kind of says step away, but the papers say retire. We'll ask Adam what that means coming up. And also all of the chatter around what might happen to Tom Brady. Okay, it's just chatter, but we can dream, right? I mean, I just think about back in Denver when Peyton Manning came to the Broncos. Everyone was saying, remember he had a bad neck, something like that. He, all that kind of stuff. He couldn't throw the ball, and he ended up getting him to two Super Bowls and winning one and ending his career that way. So it's not unheard of for an older quarterback to go to a new team. As a matter of fact, they threw up a graphic, I think, on ESPN that showed Joe Montana from the Chiefs, Brett Favre, of course, from the Packers to the Vikings, and Peyton Manning, of course, the Colts to the Broncos. So there is precedent, some of these old-time quarterbacks, and I know everybody listening to this right now, it's not even a controversial question. You would definitely want Tom Brady to come to Chicago. I don't care if he's 50. He's 62-year-old Tom Brady. It's probably better than what we have going in this 8-8 squad that underachieved in 2019. So we'll talk to Adam about not just about what should happen at the quarterback position, but what the philosophy will be, because it's not going to be great. We don't have a ton of draft picks because we're still hurting from the Khalil Mack trade. Not hurting. I mean, we got Khalil Mack. But it's not going to be easy to just use the draft as we have in the past to fill those holes. So that's coming up here in the 8 o'clock hour. As always, 312-981-7200. Also want to say thanks to 20 by 2 Chicago, the show that we did at Shuba's last night. I had a chance to talk about it last week, but performed on stage with Walter Jacobson. We did it's 20 performers getting 2 minutes each to answer the question that they pose for the show, which is, who do you think you are? That's what each is, a question is different every show. And so for our bit, I brought Walter on stage to ask him that question, but I extrapolated and went long, as I've been known to do, in answering the question, and I took up the whole 2 minutes with the question, and Walter did not say a word on stage. That was the bit. Because it was 2 minutes. We're not really going to do an interview. And the crowd got wind. They kind of figured out what I was doing about a minute and 20 in. The crowd started laughing at, because Walter was just absolutely great. He was joking, and he was like putting up his finger or, you know, gesturing like, but he didn't say anything. And big shout out to Walter Jacobson to come out and be a part of the show at Shuba's on the North Side. It was great. It was really great. Walter was great. He is a performer. He is a showman, as we say. But yeah. He was awesome, and it's a great show. I have to say to Andrew Huff and the 20x2 crew that they put together, it's just 20 great performers. I saw a lot of people I've never seen before. I saw a lot of people last night that I have seen, and it was just a really great, warm room. And I love it. Great show. Very creative. We need more of that. More creativity in 2020. That's what I say to that. So coming up, Adam Hogue, then Jason Narduzzi will be here tonight, and then Chris Jones. Tell us about the last Hamilton performance last night and what to expect from 2020. Is there going to be any new Hamiltons on the horizon? What would be a new Hamilton? They doing a James Taft play? A musical on McKinley? John Schmidt could write it. Something like that. All that's coming up tonight on 720 WGN. So stay with us.